Okay, so as kind of an introduction to the sugya of Shmitas Ksafim and Prusbul, which is very timely and an important part of our Masechta, wanted to give a little bit of an overview philosophically of the concept of Prusbul, which requires us to appreciate a lot about the aspects of Shmitas Ksafim and the related mitzvos and isurim. And that should give us a little bit of a framework as we get into the details this week. So we, Be'ez Hashem, over the course of next week, meaning we in Klal Yisrael, have a practice of filling out a Prusbul. And the Prusbul is executed traditionally at the end of the seventh year, at the end of the Shemitah year. And what it does is, well, this machlokas as to when Shmitas Ksafim actually takes effect or when the principle takes effect, but that's the way we assume that we do this at the end of the seventh year. And the whole concept of Prusbul is often misunderstood and creates a significant misimpression about how halacha works, because on the surface, the image many people have of Prusbul, and hopefully become clear that I don't think this is correct at all, but just to present it the way it's often understood, is that Prusbul is a way that the rabbis devised to evade Torah law, which requires the cancellation of loans at the end of the Shemitah year, and instead to allow the rich people to collect their loans. The rabbis found a way to get around what the Torah asks us to do. And since they were able to do that, then the next step is, how come we can't solve everything that way? How come, if the rabbis are motivated enough, they're able to get around Torah law here for the benefit of the wealthy, so why can't they do that anytime there is a challenging situation regarding halacha and its practice? So, just on the surface, I'll start to ask you, is that the impression that you have of what Prusbul is? Or do you think that sentence is correct in terms of how it frames what's happening with Prusbul? Spoiler alert. Okay, spoiler alert, I don't think so. What parts of that sentence do you think might be vulnerable? Might be... Okay, Caleb?
Benefit of wealthy.
Okay, so that's a major question. So, is the Prusbul, first of all, for the benefit of the wealthy? So that's very much an issue that we have to try to explore. Second issue is, why is it so hot in here? It got a little extreme.
Should we open the door?
Yeah, I guess so. Got a little extreme. And you see, opening the door is going to be symbolic, because as you'll see, that Caleb already caught it, that a big concern of Prusbul is the closing of doors. So that kind of works out well. And yes, indeed, opening the door allowed a breath of fresh air into the room, so that itself is symbolic of a lot of what's going on here. So, okay, the benefit of the rich people, that is point one. We have to see if that is true or not. Yes, you're on.
I would say it's probably the exact opposite. Really, it's the benefit for the poor people. Okay. Because if they're, meaning the whole point of why Hillel instituted it was to, is that people would still lend money.
Right, and how do you know that?
Gemara says it.
I think Gemara says it, right? It's very helpful. Right, so now the truth is, there is a line in the Gemara that is a little bit confusing as far as that, but we'll come back to that. But the main point is, the Gemara does say that Hillel instituted Prusbul because he saw that people were holding back from lending. Okay, what else? Anything else you think could be questioned about the statement? Yes?
Is it evading Torah law?
Oh, okay, so that's a huge one. All right, so is it evading Torah law? So that is something we also have to figure out. And that is a very major part of what we need to know as far as the backgrounds here. So let's start with these questions. And you'll see that the answers are interlinked, and also that there are many steps to each one of those questions. So we will come back very soon to the incredibly important question of who it is are we benefiting with the Prosbol is for the benefit of the rich or for the benefit of the poor. But, first of all, is it Torah law? So here the Gemara seems to address it head on. I say seems to because there's a little bit of ambiguity in terms of whether this represents the entire story or whether there is more to figure out. But at least on one level, it certainly seems like the Gemara is addressing this. So when the Gemara tells us about the institution of Prosbol, so the Gemara asks, you know, how exactly was it possible for him to do this? And so here, the Gemara, towards the bottom of Lamed Vav Mid Aleph, the Gemara says, "Amiyak amidi demidaraisa mishamta shvias, v'hiskin hillel dolei mishamta." Right, so that already is one of the key questions here. Right, the assumption that Hillel was able to come and to contradict Torah law, could that be? Right, could it be? Is it possible that the rabbis have that much power? So without getting into motivations or issues or what does it, but just what about that? So is that true that that Hillel came here and he said, the Torah says one thing, I'm saying something else. So the Gemara has a response here, at least the name of Abaye. Amar Abaye b'shviyas b'zman hazeh. V'rabbi hi, d'tani Rabbi Omer, zed dvar ha-shmita shamot, v'shtei shmita zakosu medaber, ach ha-shmita z'karka, v'ach ha-shmita z'safim, b'zman sh'ata m'shamer karka, t'mashamer k'safim, b'zman sh'iyata m'shamer karka, iyata m'shamet k'safim. So everyone saw these Gemaras already? So here, so the Gemara tells us that, again, at least within this opinion, that since Shemitah's Ksafim is Drabbanan today, because it is tied into the broader Shemitah, the more well-known aspect of Shemitah's Karkos, and Shemitah's Karkos will assume is Drabbanan, so Shemitah's Ksafim is also Drabbanan. Now, why is Shemitah's Karkos Drabbanan? So here the truth is there are a number of possibilities, not really our topic today, but it could have to do with a connection to Yovel. That's not practiced today. It could have to do with a connection to Trumas and Maestris, which is not knowing today, Midraisa is only knowing Midrabanan. It could be connected to the entire Kedusha Sa'aretz, and whether that is Minhag Torah Midrabanan. So without going into all the details there, there is strong basis to assume that Shemitah's Karkos is binding today Midrabanan only. And therefore, if Shemitah's Ksafim is linked to that, so therefore, that will be the case as well. That will also be Drabbanan. What was your question about that?
Yeah, Rashi says that it's because of the Matala of Kedushat HaAretz, right?
That's one possibility,
so
yeah.
Would you say that maybe nowadays it would be different because we have Israel, so... Like,
oh, so the question is what it means to say we have Israel. So the Kedushas Haaretz may still not necessarily be on the same level. So that is dependent on a machlokas in the Gemara that shows up a few times. It has to do with the sanctification of Ezra and whether that was intended to endure even afterwards, or whether that was only for its own time. So what exactly it's going to take to change that is all tied into a couple of other steps. So what it would take to change the more specific question of Shemitah becoming Minhag Torah is also tied into a few other flowchart kind of possibilities. If it's this, then it would take that. If it's that, it would take this, etc., etc. So it's a complex question whether that's so, but it's safe to assume that right now that has not yet changed. So it's probably the case that Shemitah's Ksafim continues to be at most Rabban. I have to say everything with a little bit of ambiguity because there's nothing in Sana Machlokas, but the most likely position is that Shemitah's Ksafim today is Drabbanan, and there's a view that does make it into the Ramah that it's even less than that, that it's not even binding me Drabbanan today. But let's work off the premise that it is Drabbanan. And here's the key line on the next side of the Amud, on the next Amud. So Chazal made the Shvius Drabanan. Chazal made Shemitah's Ksafim Drabanan as a Zecher L'Shvius. Roy Hillel Shenimnu Ha'am Milahalvos Ezeh. So Hillel saw that people were hesitating to actually lend money. Amiv v'hiskin prizbol. So he then established prizbol in response to that. Right, so that seems to already weaken some of the assumptions in that initial statement. First of all, not coming off the premise that Shvius is d'oraisa, that there's a mitzvah in the Torah of Shmitas Ksafim. And it tells us that Hillel did this because of the concern of the borrowers not being able to get the funds that they need. So what did he do? Amar v'hiskin prizbol. So he established prizbol. So now the Gemara asks the question in the opposite way. Interesting. So, is there such a thing that here Shvius is not going to be in effect and the rabbis would come and enact that it would be? So, Amar Abaye, Sheva al Taisahu. So, Abaye has the answer, Sheva al Tasa. And Rav Amar, Hefker Bezdin, Hefker. So it seems like there are two answers to explain how the second question can be addressed. That if we're going to assume Shmitas Ksafim is Drabanan, so then that presents its own question. Because that itself seems to be difficult. Why is that difficult? So Rashi explains the issue, right? And I'm going to skip the Rashi for a second because there are different ways in the Rishonim to phrase this and it's important. But what's the basic question? What's the basic challenge of there being a concept of Shvius, Shmitas Ksafim, Drabanan?
Drabanan are preventing people from getting their money that's rightfully theirs.
Right, so it seems like they are actually telling other people to steal. Right? It seems like that the borrowers are going to violate a Torah prohibition by not repaying their loans. And the Torah is telling them to do that. The rabbis are telling them to do that. So that's a real question of the rabbis undermining Torah law. So first of all, the whole inversion there is probably very surprising to a lot of people because you come from the perspective, which the Gemara did ask, that here Prizbol undermines Torah law. And ultimately the Gemara says actually it's the other way around, that Shmitas Ksafim is what undermines Torah law. And there are two answers. The answers are very important, and not for now so much. Hopefully we'll have time to explore them. So the idea, the second one is a little bit easier to explain without as much background, that Hefker, Bez Din Hefker, seems to refer to the ability of the rabbis to reassign property ownership. And through that, they can presumably negate the question of the borrower being in violation of not returning the money that he borrowed. The idea of Sheva Altasa is a more complex concept here, and it sounds like, on the surface, like it's a reference to a whole other fascinating sugya, and maybe we'll try to talk about this a little bit before Yantif if we can. If the calendar were different, it would be more helpful to illustrate, but we know that last year, for example, we couldn't blow shofar on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, and we couldn't take a lulav on the first day of Sukkot, because apparently the rabbis do have the authority sometimes to override Torah law, specifically when it's done passively, when they say, don't do something, rather than saying, say, eat non-kosher food or the like. So it sounds like this is a reference to that topic. God willing, we'll see. It's more complicated than that, but it sounds like that's what's going on. Caleb?
Rabbi, Rosh Hashanah and the first day of Sukkot of 5784 are also going to be Shabbat, and
Yeah, it happens pretty frequently. If it was happening this year, then we could illustrate it would be an appropriate shiur for us to talk about this month, because it would be more practical. So I'm just lamenting that it happens to be one of the years where it doesn't draw on that synergy. But theoretically,
it has many other beautiful things.
Yes, Baruch Hashem, everything's good, thank God. But had this been the case this year, we would be all the more inclined to address that in the shiur at that time. So, in any event, it sounds like on the surface, again, I have to be vague about every phrase because everything is totally machlokas, but it sounds like on the surface this is a reference to that. That this idea that the rabbis do have the authority to override Torah law when it's done passively, and here they're just saying, not telling you to rob a bank, right? They're not telling you to shoot somebody. They're just saying, take the money in your pocket and leave it there. Leave the money in your pocket rather than take it. Don't do anything that involves an action. Don't eat non-kosher food. We're just saying, hold on to the money and leave it where it is. Sheva al tas. And maybe that's within their authority. Okay, so far so good. So it sounds like, first and foremost, the whole issue of the rabbis evading Torah law, sounds like that's not what's happening. I mean, it sounds like, for a lot of reasons, that's not what's happening, but just first and foremost, we're not even talking about Torah law. Now, there is a Machlokas Rishonim, which we should note up front. And tomorrow, Bez Hashem, we'll have more time. I'll give you the Makoros to see this inside, so you can take a look. It sounds like there is a Machlokas between the Rambam and the Ravid, and other Rishonim as well, just how significant this Daraisa Darabanan distinction is. That according to the Rambam, the way the Rambam formulates it in Mishneh Torah, this only works, Prizbul only works, because we're dealing with a Din Darabanan. It is contingent on that fact. And the Ravid disagrees. And the Ravid understands that it could work on a level even in HaTorah. That Prizbul could have been functional even if Shemitah's Ksafim is Daraisa. And that the language here that connects it to a Din Rabbanan is significant but not necessary for it to function because we have Hefker, Bez, and Hefker. And Hefker, Bez, and Hefker, as we understand, and as the Gemara here is telling us, functions even on a level of Minat Torah. So, it sounds like Hefker, Bez, and Hefker was referring in the Gemara to the Shemitah's Ksafim itself. But you could also understand that the Hefker, Bez, and Hefker could apply to the Prizbul, and apply to the lack of Shemitah's Ksafim. So that should work even on a level of Minat Torah. So let's think about this distinction for a second, because it's important, right? So either the functionality of Prizbul is tied into it being a Drabbanan, which tells us something about what Chazal are doing regarding Torah law, and possibly about the limits of Tinim Drabbanan and Torah law. While according to the Ravid, that's not the issue. So if that's not the issue, so then do we care at all that it's Drabbanan? Apparently, yes, right? The Gemara seems to link them. So what might be at play here, and this is just step one, there's more to it, but if we do feel like Prizbul is on any level getting around what the Torah wants us to do, so then this might be an important point to bring up. Because even if we're satisfied that Prizbul works, and even if we are able to accept that the Torah tells us to cancel loans and Prizbul is able to stop that and make us not required to cancel loans, how would we feel about using it if that was a mitzvah minat Torah? Right, this is a very fundamental question. If the Torah says we're supposed to cancel our loans and we find a mechanism that is able to stop that from happening and it's 100% effective, but it means that we're not going to be canceling our loans, we have a clear conscience 100%? Right, this is one of the fundamental issues here. Ezra, what do you think?
Not so much a clear conscience.
Not so much a clear conscience, right? Why not?
It doesn't seem to be like what the Torah had in mind.
Right, so it sounds like Torah is telling us to do something, and we found a way to get out of it. And it's not going to make us feel so good. So the distinction between Torah law and rabbinic law might be very significant. It may be that when it was Torah law, Prizbul also could have worked. But we would not have been comfortable using. So the institution or the initiative of Hillel here is advocating something which, had it regarded Torah law, maybe he wouldn't have advocated. But because it's a Din Rabbanan, that plays a crucial role in why we're comfortable recommending this route. So, what does that say? Does it say that we don't care about rabbinic law as much? We don't care about what the rabbis want? We only care about what the Torah wants? Shmuel?
I think it signifies that the reason why we care about doing Torah law and rabbinic law might be slightly different.
Okay, that's very interesting. So, can you expand on that?
Like, maybe Torah law, like, it's more inherent where rabbinic,
okay,
where, or is completely inherent where rabbinic law, it's like when, nothing, it's, I'm forgetting, like you
spoke about the last
year.
Right, so I'll help you out. So basically there's a couple of steps here. So there is a position that's often quoted from the Sefer Bechor Shor that was written in the 1700s, by Alexander Shor, where he is talking about Mechiras Chametz, which he doesn't love so much, or doesn't seem to love so much. And he, I have to say again, seems, because there's a machlokus about everything, so it's very hard to say anything with absolute terms, but it sounds like the Bechor Shor, I'm going to leave out the sounds like for a second and just say it the way it's most often understood. But the Bechor Shor criticizes Mechiras Chametz, the selling of Chametz for Pesach. And he calls it a harama. He calls it a evasion, essentially. And he puts forward there a principle that an evasion is only acceptable if you're dealing with rabbinic law. But if you're dealing with Torah law, we don't allow evasions. So that might be lurking here. Right? It could be that if Shemitah was Daraisa, if Shemitah's Ksafim was Daraisa, so then, yes, it might be possible that Prisbol would function anyway, but we wouldn't be happy about it. Or we wouldn't even allow it, perhaps. In other words, it could be functional, but we would say you're still not allowed to do it because you are getting around what the Torah wants, and that's wrong to do. But when it's rabbinic law, it could be there's a different landscape. Now, this is step one, and I'll take Paul's question a second. That's the rough position of the Bechor Shor. There's a lot to say about it. He does not really explain why that distinction should exist, other than pointing to a Gemara that seems to support his position. But the logic isn't really provided. But that's the basic principle, that we have different attitudes towards rabbinic law and Torah law, and therefore that would impact how we would look at this. Cause?
So don't we only say that it's only like taken down from the size of the rest of the Rabbanan because the Chachamim made a takana about it? Meaning, if the Chachamim didn't make that takana, then it would still be Daraisa. So can we also ask the question?
Well, not exactly. We assume that it would be only Daraisa because of other reasons. And those reasons aren't in effect, whether something connected to Shemitah's Karkos, whether it's about Yovel or about Meisr or about Kedushas Haaretz. Mm-hmm. So that would apparently knock it out completely. And the rabbis came and they made a new Shemitah. They made a Zecher L'Shvius, a Shemitah's Ksafim. So within that, so then Prisbol arose. So the question is, does it only arise in that context because Torah law would not have functioned with it? Or maybe it could have functioned with it, but that would have been wrong, because that would be avoiding the intent of the Torah. And especially if you take the position of the Bechor Shor, it's not the only way to come at this, but that's just one prominent voice here, that we draw a line there. We don't allow evasions by rabbinic law, by Torah, only by rabbinic law. So maybe that's in the background here. Hi.
But could it be, and this is more of a Hashkafic point as well.
Well, there's Hashkafic point
very
much embedded here.
Shir.
Yeah, so embedded in this is, but go on.
So, but could it be that Bizman Shabbat Mikdash Kayam, or Yikayim, that people, Lovim will, if we're worthy of the Beit HaMikdash, then the people who will be lending will be more than happy to lend without a prosbul. And that the times will be such that people will not need a prosbul to do Shemitat Ksafim. Whereas today, when we don't have a Beit HaMikdash, and I guess we're, and then it could be reflective of the fact that we need the prosbul.
Okay, there's definitely a lot to that. I mean, it's not necessarily about the Beit HaMikdash specifically, but the whole interlocking of parts here, and I'll give a little bit of a teaser for what's yet to come, that it's certainly possible to reframe it a little bit, and that there's something about the whole package of Shemitah which changes the landscape, and which if Shemitah's Drabbanan, we don't have that same story. So that much, I think, is going to play a big role.
Right. For example, does the bracha does the bracha that we'll have enough food in the sixth year, exist because Shemitah is
excellent. Okay, that's a huge issue. That is a huge part of it. So now we're going to come back to more of it, but let's try to contextualize this. So first of all, just the whole idea of being Drabbanan, we do find different attitudes in halakha. But it still requires more explanation, because why shouldn't we care about the rabbis too? Right? So we're only feeling guilty about avoiding the Torah's intent, but we don't feel guilty about avoiding the rabbi's intent? Why shouldn't we worry about that also? So Shmuel laid the foundation a little bit to take this a step further. And it could be that there is a fundamental difference between what the rabbi's intent even is. That, for example, which may not be the perfect fit for here, but let's say if we're talking about a safeguard, the rabbi has made a rule to protect some Torah law. So then, like Shmuel was alluding to, there's a difference. The Torah law has some inherent concept behind it. So even if we were able to somehow follow the rules, but we weren't really fitting the intent of the Torah, it means that we are contradicting whatever that value is. While when it comes to rabbinic law, especially, let's say, if it's some kind of a safeguard, so then it doesn't reflect that there's anything in here especially. The whole idea is that we are supposed to create a buffer zone. But beyond that, the whole mandate of rabbinic law, like we read in the parasha 2 weeks ago, Parasha Shoftim, is a broad mandate of listening to the rabbis. So it could be that you don't have the same letter of the law, spirit of the law distinction when it comes to rabbinic law. That the Torah has an intent behind every mitzvah and the rules to observe that mitzvah. But rabbinic law, the major thrust of the whole concept, is to follow the rules. So if we're following the rules, so then we are fulfilling the intent of the rabbis. And maybe that puts things on a different scale just in and of itself. Hi.
Couldn't one, say, though, that, while the halachic imperative of following the spirit of the law might not be there, it almost would be wise to, because
I think it might be, and we'd have to try to understand within every concept what exactly is going on, because not all rabbinic laws are the same. So we'd have to try to really analyze each one by itself. But broadly speaking, there might be some general attitude that distinguishes it could come from that. So now, could take it further and say, what about this din d'rabbanan specifically? Is there a difference that the landscape is affected by the fact that we're dealing with rabbinic law that very much changes the way the parts come together? Hi.
Yeah, so it seems like there is, because like Rashi says that, based on the Gemara where it says, Zeikar l'shvias, it says, Shalot tishdechach Torah's shvias.
Ah.
But it seems like it does have to do with the actual concept.
Okay, so that's step one. That's very important to know, right? The fact is, you could just ask the question, so what did the rabbis have in mind when they instituted Rabbinic Shemitah's Ksafim? Is it that they wanted this practice to continue, even when the Torah is not mandating it? Or did they want something else, and that there should be a memory of Shvias? and that that should endure. And if there's a different goal there, so maybe that allows us to see things differently. So Ezra's point is very well taken, right? That Rashi is telling us an important clue, coming off the language of the Gemara, of Zeichel Shvi'at, that this does not seem to have the same intent as the Torah version. The Torah Shemitah's Ksafim may have one purpose to it, and the Rabbinic Shemitah's Ksafim does not necessarily have the same purpose. And that itself may be a part of the puzzle. Now, let's briefly also address Caleb's point, but we'll say more about it a little bit later, and this Hakdama, I guess, may become a two-part Hakdama. We'll have to spill over a little bit into tomorrow. But is the whole background different because it is Drabbanan? Now, that's a question I'm just going to allude to right now, and we'll say more about it later. But does Shemitah's Ksafim in HaTorah represent a certain mentality and a certain reality, certain metaphysical reality, that is not applicable to Shemitah's Ksafim Drabbanan? That maybe there's a whole package that comes together with Shemitah that is not necessarily all in effect when Shemitah is Drabbanan. So just to say a sentence about this, and we'll come back to it, but there is a major debate that continues to rage today, and a part of what we'll have to see, I guess, tomorrow, is that the two halves of Shemitah, each of them have kind of a mechanism to what seems like get around them or neutralize them. They're not at all comparable as far as their level of acceptability. That when it comes to Shemitah's Karkaos, there's an idea of the Heter Mechira, of selling the land in Israel for the duration of Shemitah, so that the land can continue to be worked. And for Shemitah's Ksafim, we have this notion of Prisbol. They do not parallel each other at all as far as how they are accepted. And Prisbol, we see coming back to the Mishnah here, Prisbol has a pedigree which goes back to Hillel, and even though there is some machlokas about it in the Gemara here, but in practice today, there's no machlokas about Prisbol, for the most part. I have to hedge on every word, but there's the idea that Prisbol is accepted is not really in question. While when it comes to Heter Mechira is hugely, hugely controversial. And you could call it a perpetual motion machine for machlokas, because the fighting that goes on about the Heter Mechira has continued at full force for the past 150 years or so, and every 7 years it gets renewed, and the facts around it change. And each side says, okay, 7 years ago you didn't agree with me, but now you must agree with me. And the other side says the same thing. And it gets very intense. So the level of acceptability between these two concepts don't match at all, even though you would think they seem related and parallel. And one issue that does parallel, that Caleb's alluding to, is when it comes to Shemitah's Karkos. So some of those who object to the Heter Mechira, so they say, what's the big surprise that Shemitah is hard? The Torah was clear that Shemitah is going to be hard, and that it requires emunah. That's a huge part of it. And it says, God promises a bracha, v'tzivisi esprachasi, God promises us that he will help us through it. So you're betraying this promise, the argument goes, by not fulfilling Shemitah in the way it's described, and by seeking any kind of an alternative approach. So some of the defenders of the Heter Mechira responded to that, including notably Gus Vengel, that's all very well and good if Shemitah's Karkos, if Shemitah was a Dimon HaTorah. So when God is telling us to observe Shemitah, so then he makes the promise that follow these rules and I will take care of you. But if Shemitah is not Min HaTorah, so then what right do we have to assume that we'll be taken care of the same way? What right do we have to assume that the bracha is still in effect? So, for example, the way Vrsvengo put it, he said, that's some kanalanes. If you think that, then you're relying on a miracle that no one promised. It doesn't say that in the Torah. So what right do you have to take such risks when it doesn't look like it's going to be possible? He was addressing a scenario where there was really very different context to the economics of the question. So if it looks so daunting, and we don't have the Torah telling us to do this and then backing that up with a promise, so then he says it would be somech alanes, you'd be relying on miracles to take this path. And others disagreed for a number of reasons. But this is what Caleb is alluding to, that it's a big question that when you're dealing with a din min ha-Torah, so the whole philosophy might change. But dealing with a din d'rabbanan, we don't necessarily know that that's true. And that may require us to take different kinds of approaches. Okay, so far so good? Okay, so we'll have to explain all that tomorrow, but just one or two other points before, so we'll have this also in our bags here. So the question of who is Puzbol for the benefit of, so we should acknowledge that there is one line here in the Gemara that does throw a little confusion into it, that the Gemara in the bottom of Lamed Vav Mid Bay is going to the top of Lamed Zayin Amud Aleph. So the Gemara says, my Prizbul. Well, what is Prizbul? Meaning, what is the word Prizbul? So Amar Rav Chisda, Prusbuli Ubuti. So Prus, first of all, you see how words are spelled differently, that in the Gemara, it's with a Samach, and the Dibur HaMaskel and Rashi, it's with a Zayin, the same thing. So this is a Greek word, Pashtus Prusbul. So Prus, Rashi says, it's a takana, this is an enactment. For who? So bully or buti, right? So we don't like bullies, but in this case, who are the bullies? So maybe appropriately, I guess this is the dynamic often, the bullies are the rich kids, right? The bully are the Ashirim, and buti are the Aniyim. So who is it for? So Ashirim shall yafsidu, vaniyim shall yinu dalos bifneihim. Right, so who is it for? It could be for either one. It could be for the rich, so that they should not lose out. Or it could be for the poor, so that they don't lose their opportunity to get the loans. And that's what we mentioned before about the door open, that this is an expression that you find throughout Shas. This is a very strong consideration, as we mentioned last week in the context of the first parak where it came up there, that the idea of ni'ilas delos b'fnei lovin, that we don't want doors to be slammed in front of those who need to borrow, and that's what we're afraid of. So it sounds like here the Gemara has it as kind of an open question that it could be for both, and you might also have the impression that it's really the rich people who went out here as the beneficiaries. Why? Because we call it pros bull and not pros but. So it sounds like the bullies won, and that's what it's a takana for. It's a takana for the rich. However, I'll take question in a second, but that's just a very superficial perspective, because first of all, even when we say it's a takana for the rich, it's really a roundabout way of saying that we mean a spiritual takana for them, because if they're going to hold back, as we shall see, they're going to be in violation of Torah prohibitions. So that's also a part of it, and it could be that their fear of losing their money is what's driving them to violate these Torah prohibitions, but we need to save them from that. So that's another way of understanding the enactment for the rich. It all still comes from the benefit of the poor. And the Maram Shik has a whole discussion here about our favorite topic, about the synergy here. It's a negative synergy, that essentially you'll have different kinds of rich people. So some of them will be less noble and will hold back from lending money, and that's the biggest concern. But even the tzaddikim among the rich, who are going to lend anyway, are going to have to extend themselves much more, because they're not going to have others who are lending together with them. So the rich tzaddikim are going to have to pick up the slack for the rich lesser than tzaddikim, and they're going to have to lend more than they can. And the poor people are going to have a harder time finding people who can lend to them, because only the very righteous among the rich are going to lend to them. So they're going to be still further disadvantaged. And they're going to then be less likely to be able to pay back, because they had a hard time getting all their needs covered. So then the rich people are going to have to cover the losses that they get, because the people they lended to, who was more than they were able to lend to begin with, they had to push themselves further, and now they're not going to get repaid because the poor have less of a pool to draw from. So it's a vicious cycle. There's a lot of negative synergy here. It's going to result in greater losses to the poor and greater losses to the rich, and greater transgressions by the rich who aren't lending, and the whole world is going to pay the price here. So there's going to be a whole cycle of negativity, but it all stems from the fact that the poor need help and they're not going to get the help because of this idea. So that's just to address this line of the Gemara, which could have been a little bit confusing as far as who we're really trying to help here. So to try to address that. But the truth is, the Gemara, as you guys pointed out, is pretty explicit what the purpose is. And so the Gemara, the beginning of this whole sugya, Lamivav Mod Aleph, so what's the language of the Gemara? So, Tanan Hasam, Prosbul Einam Meshameit, Prosbul cancels the cancellation. Ze Achab and Advarim Shehiskin Hil Hazakin. This is one of the things Hil Hazakin into it. Shara Esam, Shenimnu Mulahalvo says. So he saw that they held back from lending. So it seems very clear there that it's not that he's trying to find a way to help the rich not lose out on their repayments. The Torah wanted them not to get paid, but Hillel said, ha-ha, my rich friends, I'll take care of you, and I'll make sure that you can get paid. But what was driving him was that the poor were not getting the loans in the first place. And then the next part of it is equally crucial. The avru al mashakas in the Torah, that puts them in violation of the Torah, where it says, "Yishamer lecha pinya davar im levavcha bli'al." So here the Torah has this very strong language that you should be careful. Yishamer is the lashon of prohibition. That's the lav in the Torah. It's one of the words the Torah uses to issue a lo saseh. That there might come into your heart a thought that is bli'al. What does bli'al mean?
Negative.
Negative is a good way to say it, because it's not clear exactly how to translate it, but we know it's negative. We know that this is not a good thing, that this is a harsh term, and the same Parashas Re'eh, so that's where this is from, Parashas Re'eh, read it a few weeks ago. The Torah uses in Parashas Re'eh a little bit earlier that word Bli'al to refer to Avodah Zarah, to Mesis and Midiach, so it's not a good thing to be called the Bli'al. So thank you. Negative is correct, is probably the most succinct way of saying it. And it seems to be made up of words like bli'ol, that you feel like you have no sense of responsibility, no sense of responsibility to God, no sense of responsibility to the needy. All in all, it is not something you want to be called. So perhaps there will be this thought of negativity, of a lack of responsibility, a lack of commitment, and you're going to hold back from lending. So here the Gemara really seems to tell us very clearly what the motivation was. It wasn't that rich people were lending, but we want to make sure that we can get around the Torah's goal of having them cancel their loans. And keep in mind also that ribis, interest, is prohibited, so it's not as if there would have been any benefit to the rich other than just getting back what they laid out. They're not looking to try to collect more. In which case, if there was, then you could really think this was some kind of a device to help the rich. Let the rich issue loans and collect interest and not have to cancel it, but they're not collecting interest anyway. And even the getting repaid is not the issue. The Gemara tells us straight out what the issue is. The issue was that they weren't lending in the first place. And if they don't lend in the first place, so then that impacts the poor, first and foremost, that they're not going to get the help that they need. And it also impacts the rich, that they're going to be in violation of a very harshly worded Isser Min HaTorah. So all of this is important background. And I'll just say, well, actually we'll have to daven mincha now, but you see here that it's not just that we can say, we can be very moralistic about it and say, well, the rich people should be better and they should just lend no matter what. But we know that we can't rely on that happening because people have all kinds of overt and hidden motives, and the poor just aren't going to get the help that they need. So as much as we can be very virtuous and say, well, I've got to do it anyway, that's great, but it's going to result still in the poor losing out, and we have to worry more about that than we have to worry about whether the people are being as righteous as they should be, as much as that's what we want as well. But the first and foremost issue is that the poor should get the help that they need. So a lot more to say about this, so God willing, we will pick up with that tomorrow. Everyone should have a wonderful day, and I look forward to getting in somewhere.